It'll be coming back on that Van Wyck Expressway.
Okay.
So yeah, come back.
This is a back road.
Okay.
Going there usually not too much difficulty. This is the Incredible Sayan Baba.
Oh. Oh, you found that book. I ordered it. I got another book from that.
Oh, well, this is the first edition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the one that came out.
Arthur
late.
Was one.
By Arthur Osborne. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. He's a Bhagavan devotee. He wrote Ramana Maharshi in the Path of Self-Knowledge. Oh. So this is 1957.
Mm-hmm. Is that the one that's signed?
What?
Is that the one that's signed?
Signed by who?
You've had one of her books was signed by, I don't know.
Oh, that was Christopher Isherwood.
Yeah.
And Pramavana. Mm-hmm. This is 1957 before he became the most worldwide famous guru, which he is now. Mm-hmm. Temples he were. Even tour on the Giri Production on trail. Shortly after the death of Saya Baba, the late Swami B.B. Narasimha Swami made a collection of his sayings and the anecdotes about him, which he entitled Sri Saya Baba's Charters and Sayings. He also collected statements of their experiences from a considerable number of devotees and published them in three volumes under the title Devotees' Experiences of Saya Baba. Both these books were published without copyright by the All India Saya Samaj at Madras, of which Swami Narasimha Swami was president. He was the one who wrote the first biography of Bhagavan, published in 1931. That's B.B. Narasimha Swami.
Okay.
The 1930s.
31, he was published. I spoke to the Swami before his demise of my intention of writing a life of Saya Baba, and he requested me to make full use of all the publications of the Samaj. I wish to acknowledge my indebtedness for the help I derived from these sources.
The Arthur Osborne's?
Yeah.
He also lived there, right, for some time?
Actually,
in the Sai Baba's...
In Shirdi?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think so. Not that I'm
talking about. But he visited, right?
Perhaps.
And he wrote another biography on of Shirdi's head.
This is it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where did you get this from? Her?
Cynthia.
Gopala
Krishna. This is the first edition. 1957. Forward. It is perfectly true, as the author remarks, this is written by Ramdas, Ananda Ashram. Swami Ramdas, from Kanagad. You heard of him?
Yeah.
Papa Ramdas. Yeah.
You've been there?
No. I don't want that.
They start the Ramnam chant or the
morning? Yeah, it's going on continuously, right?
24
hours. It is perfectly true, as the author remarks, that Sri Saya Baba, although well known all over India, is not known outside India. Not anymore. You know, he's
not
the most
anymore.
Popular guru in the world.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, there's two temples here in Queens. There's two going around the Giriprakha. In every country you'll see, you know.
Every cab driver in Tirunamalai has this picture.
Oh.
Just about.
In India, definitely, but around the world, yes. And that Satya Sai Baba used to say he's an incarnation, but he'd gone now. Everybody reverted back to him. And they tried to get Arthur Osborne to write a biography on Satya Sai Baba, but he wouldn't do it. He put a lot of pressure on him. The author wishes to introduce him to the Western world. With this laudable object in view, he has written this book, which contains Sri Saya Baba's brief life, teachings, miracles, and anecdotes. Although Sri Saya Baba's life, as depicted in the book based on authentic reports of his devotees, is strange and eccentric, No one who has come in contact with him and his devotees can deny the fact that he was, and Ram Dass can say, he is a saint of the highest spiritual eminence. Ram Dass had the privilege of visiting Sirdi about 4 years ago for the darshan of Baba Samadhi. He found that the atmosphere in the mandir where the samadhi is located was vibrating with spiritual peace and joy. Sai Baba seems to be still living in that holy place. Another wonderful sight that met Ram Dass's eyes was that a regular stream of devotees was pouring into the temple for the darshan of Baba's samadhi throughout the day. In Ram Dass's wanderings in different parts of India and during his visits to the houses of devotees, he also discovered everywhere pictures of Sai Baba adorning the walls. His popularity is so vast and wide that his name has become almost a household word among the people of India, who hold him in the highest veneration because he fulfills what he said, that I give them what they want so they may want what I want to give.
Mm.
So many people get their prayers fulfilled. So that's why he's so popular, he fulfills desires. Bhagavan destroys it. That's why you only see a few people. Sai Baba is a most potent spiritual force that molds and transforms the life of spiritual aspirants who seek his guidance and blessings even to this day. The author, Sri Arthur Osborne, has done an invaluable service to the seekers of truth in the West by presenting this book to the world. He has, in the spirit of love and devotion to Sai Baba, related the most important events in his life, which stand out in bold perspective, conveying to the heart of the reader the preeminent glory of Sai Baba. Sai Baba's divine personality seems to have captured the heart of the author, and he writes about him with such a spontaneity, giving details of the life and miracles culled from various sources, that he cannot but create in the heart of the reader a wave of admiration and devotion for this great spiritual master. Ram Dass earnestly wishes that this book should be in the hands of every spiritual aspirant, and for the matter of that, everyone, whether he is a believer or a non-believer, so that he can know how God reveals himself in the form of a unique and fully inspired saint of Sai Baba's stature. Sai Baba's sayings are quite original in their import and expression. The last quotation from Baba's sayings, as mentioned in this book, has charmed Ram Dass, and he will end this short foreword by giving it here. Quote, I give people what they want and hope that they will begin to want what I want to give them. Chapter 1, Introducing Sai Baba. Look, here comes the crazy fakir again. Quote, unquote. The shopkeeper.
Here comes what?
The crazy fakir. The shopkeeper turned and looked up the street at the tall, gaunt youth who was striding towards them, energetic but aloof, speaking to nobody. No one knew who he was. He had first appeared in the little town of Shirdi as a lad of about 16 in 1872. As wandering fakirs do, none knowing whence or why, he wandered away again, roamed about for a while, and then came back and spent the rest of his life there. During his earlier visits, he lived under a neem tree, sitting there in the daytime, sleeping on the bare ground at night, eating what little food the charitable townsfolk gave him. When he stopped wandering and settled down at Shirdi, he went first to a little Hindu temple there, intending to make it his abode, but the custodian, Mahal Sapati, who later became one of his closest disciples, regarded him as a Muslim fakir and refused him admission, bidding him to go to the mosque to live. He did so, and the little mud-walled mosque remained his home. He spoke with the holy men, Hindu or Muslim, who occasionally passed through the town, and one of them had told the townsfolk watch that young fakir. He's a jewel of a dunghill.
Jewel on a dunghill.
Oh, I see. That's totally different reading.
Jewel on a
dunghill. What did she say?
Jewel on a dunghill.
Yeah, he said, when he read it, so I was quite confused.
But they had not taken much notice. It seemed more likely to them that he was a bit cracked. He did not mix with them, scarcely spoke. He sometimes said namaz, a ritualist Islamic prayer that has to be said 5 times a day, but very seldom. He had queer habits of his own, too. He kept a fire burning perpetually in the little mosque, more like a Parsi than a Muslim, and he burned little oil lamps there. Except for a handful of food, oil for the lamps was the only thing he needed, and he used to go to the shopkeepers to beg it. That was what he must be coming for now. One of them nudged the other. Let's have some fun with him. Let's refuse to give him any oil. A sprinkling of sightseers gathered round. Refused oil, the young fakir turned and went back with no word of complaint or beseeching. Let's follow him back and see what he'll do, someone suggested. The old herd instinct of baiting the outsider was at work. They soon saw, arrived back at the mosque, the fakir picked up a mud pot of water that stood there and filled the lamps from it. And they burned, as with oil. There was no nudging or tittering now. In sudden awe, they fell at the feet and begged him not to curse them for what they had done. No more talk of crazy fakirs. The people of Shirdi believed now in the jewel on the dunghill. They knew that they had a man of power among them. They soon found that he was a saint and teacher with enormous compassion for those who suffer. Nevertheless, he remained bizarre, a man of mystery. Nobody knew his name. Saya Baba is not a name. Saya, pronounced approximately like Sai, is a Persian word for saint. And Baba is a Hindu term of endearment and respect, meaning father. Nobody knew why he chose Shirdi as his abode, rather a village than a town, 6 miles from the nearest railway station, not previously a spiritual center, and yet he remained there for nearly half a century, till his death in 1918, while ever more devotees flocked around from the towns. If there was a personal reason, it was as strange as the whole circumstance of his life. Many years later, when he was already famous, he told a devotee to dig at the foot of the neem tree where he used to sit on his first arrival there. A tomb was unearthed, and he declared that it was that of his guru, not in this life, but in the previous incarnation.
He died in his 60s.
1918.
18, so he would have been roughly about 60 years old because he was 16.
Then he 1976. Nobody knew why he chose Shirdi. Okay. So far, as this life goes, practically nothing is known of his early years. It is fairly certain that he was born of a middle-class Brahmin family in a small town in Hyderabad state. Possibly his parents died when he was young, because at a very early age he left home to follow a Muslim fakir. A few years later, the fakir died, and he joined a Hindu guru. He was deeply attached to this guru, whom he referred to by the affectionate diminutive of Venkusa. He has told the story of how they met, of their life together. Once I was discussing the Puranas and other works we were reading with 3 friends and arguing how to attain realization. One said that we should depend on ourselves and not on a guru, because the Gita says, raise yourself. The second said that the main thing is to control the mind and to keep it free from thoughts and doubts. The third said that forms are always changing and only the formless is unchanging. So we must constantly make distinction between the eternal and the transitory. The fourth disliked theory. He said, let us simply do our duty and surrender our whole life and body and speech to a guru who is all-pervading. Faith in him is all that is needed. As we roamed through the forest, we met a laborer who asked us where we were going in the heat of the day and warned us that we should get lost in the trackless thickets and for no purpose. He invited us to stay and share his food. But we rejected his offer and advice and walked on. And in fact, we did lose our way in that vast, dense forest. He met us a second time and said that we had got lost through trusting to our own skill and that we needed a guide. Again, he invited us to share his food, telling us that such an offer was auspicious and should not be spurned. However, we again declined his invitation and continued on our way. Only I felt hungry and went back and accepted a piece of bread from him and drank some water. Then the guru appeared and asked what we were arguing about, and I told him all about it. The others left him, showing him no respect, but I bowed down to him reverently. Then he took me to a well, tied my legs with rope, and suspended my head downwards from the tree that was growing beside it. My head was about 3 feet above the water, so that I could not reach it. My guru left me there and went away. Is this all an allegorical, story? I don't know if it's a real thing. I knew not where. He returned 4 or 5 hours later and asked me how I was getting on. How's it going? I replied that I had passed my time in great bliss. So, ready to be pulled out. He was delighted with me and embraced me, passing his hand over my head and body. He spoke to me with great love and made me his disciple, whereupon I entirely forgot my mother and father and all my desires. I loved to gaze on him. I had no eyes except for him. I did not want to go back. I forgot everything but the guru. My whole life was concentrated in my sight and my sight on him. He was the object of my meditation. In silence, I bowed to him. This is the typical Sai Baba account because the whole story is symbolical.
Yes.
The forest is the jungle of the mind in which the quest for truth takes place. And the four friends are four modes of approach. The laborer is a guru, and the food he offers is his grace. The guru appeared, meaning that after the youth has accepted the food, he discovers that the river of it, the giver of it, really is a divine guru. Therefore, he bows reverently. That is, accepts his authority. Tying him head downward over a well is overturning the ego, binding it and holding it within sight of the cool waters of peace. Incidentally, this mode of discipline has been used physically by some masters. It is because of this that the ordeal is blissful. It is suffering beatified by the end for which it is endured. The absorption in the guru is the sadhana or path followed, and the final in silence I bow down is extinction of the ego and realization. A guru normally guides his disciples along the path that he himself has trodden. and therefore this account has importance with reference to chapter 6, where Sai Baba's spiritual training of his devotees is considered. On another occasion he said, after my fakir's death, his widow left me with Venkusha at Selu. I stayed with him for 12 years and then left Selu. Even here, the 12 may be merely symbolical of a completed period, the 12 signs of the zodiac. It can scarcely be literally true if Sai Baba was only 16 when he first went to Shirdi after the death of his guru. He is said to have been 8 when he left home, and a few years with the fakir must be allowed. It is characteristically bizarre that all his life he kept with him a common brick that his guru had given him. When finally it dropped and broke in 1918, shortly before his death, he said, "It is not the brick that is broken, but my karma. I shall not survive its breaking." It is obviously not necessary to know about his early life or training. If it had been, he would have told us. It was about 1900 that Sai Baba's fame began to spread, and since then it has continued. In a town as far distant as Madras, you can walk down a bazaar street and in the shop after shop see his bust or portrait, often with incense sticks burning before it. There is probably no saint in India who has more devotees or whose cult is so widespread, a statement which does not include Rama or Krishna, who are, strictly speaking, not saints, but avatars. And yet, Sai Baba is almost unknown outside India. To the best of my knowledge, no life of him has been published by any Western publisher in any European language. Why such a discrepancy? I suggest that it is because Sai Baba does not accord with the modern conception of a saint. That is that he should lead a decorous life, not performing too many or too startling miracles, and should expound his teaching and philosophy on which the scholars can write these, arguing that for X, the world was purely illusory, while for Y, it possessed an indisputable, though transitory reality, or some such rubbish. Whereas, in fact, the great sages speak from knowledge, not opinions, and any contradictions there maybe between them are due to either to the impossibility of expressing the ineffable in words, or to the choice of one viewpoint or another to suit the particular type of disciple. There are many different viewpoints of a mountain peak from its base, and a master may turn his light on one or another, and on the path leading up from it, such paths illumined by various masters may cross as they wind up the mountainside, so that the short-sighted geographer can prove that they run in opposite directions, but the master knows the summit, which is one, and knows that they all lead there. Sai Baba never wrote a book. His behavior was bizarre, and he flaunted his miracles with the reckless exuberance of a child. No easy saint to introduce to the modern reader. Not only did he not write books, he did not read them either. He did occasionally instruct a devotee to read some religious scriptural work, but for the most part he encouraged or discouraged them from reading. People hope to find Brahma in those books, but it is Brahma, confusion, not Brahma, God, that they find there. Brahma.
Brahma.
Confusion?
Brahma.
Brahma. Brahma. In India they don't say the A. Brahma, right?
Yeah.
No, but Brahma is a different word. Brahma meaning doubt. But Brahma is the word, the way he's referring to Brahma.
There is nothing unorthodox in such a statement. Some basic theoretical understanding is necessary, except in very rare cases. But continued accumulation of theoretical knowledge does not help towards spiritual understanding. Indeed, mental study can distract a man from the more arduous task of spiritual effort with the false allure of an easy alternative. Particularly in this age, when such floods of books are churned out, it is a danger. Sri Ramakrishna also neither practiced nor enjoined scholarship. Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi, though enormously erudite, wrote in a derogatory way of book learning, quote, "It is the unlearned who are saved rather than those whose ego has not subsided despite their learning. The unlearned are saved from the unrelenting grip of self-infatuation, from the malady of the myriad whirling thoughts, from the endless pursuit of mental wealth. It is not from one ill alone that they are saved." 40 verses, the supplement, verse 36. The unlearned state described here means, of course, not mere ignorance, but the simplicity and integrity of mind which Taoism extols, which Christ designated as like a little child, which Islam implies in the illiteracy of the prophet. It is not incompatible with learning. Nevertheless, learning cannot produce it, and absorption in learning can destroy it. For years, it was doubted whether Sai Baba was even literate. Certainly, nobody supposed that he knew Sanskrit. Then one day he gave an exposition which showed learning as well as the perspicacity and rough humor natural to him. A devotee was massaging his legs and feet, chanting to himself the while in an undertone. Sai Baba asked him what he was muttering. "A Sanskrit verse," he replied, not suspecting that Sai Baba knew enough scripture to want a more precise answer. However, he asked, "What verse?" "A verse from the Gita. Say it aloud." The devotee then recited the Sanskrit verse 34 of chapter 4. "Know that by means of prostration, inquiry, and service, the jnanis, the enlightened, who have realized the truth, will teach you jnana, knowledge." "Do you understand this, Nana?" Baba asked him. "Yes." "Then tell me the meaning." Nana gave a free rendering in the vernacular, but Sai Baba was not satisfied. "I don't want a paraphrase. I want the strict grammatical meaning with case, mood, and tone." And tense. Nana gave a literal translation, wondering the while whether Baba knew anything of Sanskrit grammar. He soon found out. "In tat vidhi, what does tat stand for?" Baba asked him. "Jnana, knowledge." "What knowledge?" "Knowledge of what?" "The knowledge referred to in the previous stanzas." "What does pranapat mean?" "Prostration." "And pat?" "The same." "If that meant the same, would Vyasa, the legendary author of the Mahabharata and the epic which is the Bhagavad Gita is an episode, have added two unnecessary syllables?" "I don't see any difference between them," Nana admitted. Baba left that for a while and passed on to the next point. "What does prasana or prasna mean?" "Asking questions." "And periprasana?" "The same." "Then if they both mean the same, was Vyasa off his head to use longer?" "I don't see any difference." "Next point. What does seva mean?" "Service, such as I am now doing, massaging your legs." "Nothing more?" "I don't see what more it can mean." "We'll leave that too." "Next point. Krishna tells Arjuna to get jnana, knowledge, from jnanis." "Wasn't Krishna himself a jnani?" "Yes." then why does he send Arjuna to others instead of giving him jnana himself? I don't know. Wasn't Arjuna a jiva being and therefore an emanation of Chaitanya, universal consciousness? Yes. Then how can knowledge be given to what is already an emanation of consciousness or knowledge? Saya Baba then interpreted the verse to mean that it is not jnana, knowledge, but anjnana, non-knowledge, or ignorance, that the Guru gives. Nana, now thoroughly bewildered over what had seemed to him a straightforward verse, asked Saya Baba to expound these points. He explained, the verse tells us how a disciple is to approach his Guru in order to attain realization. He must completely surrender body, mind, soul, and possessions to the Guru. Footnote. Sai Baba himself did not demand the surrender of the property of his disciples. It is a question of attitude of mind. There must be complete readiness to surrender all. That is the prostration referred to. The inquiry must be the constant quest for truth, not questions asked out of mere curiosity or for a wrong motive, such as to trap the Guru. The motive must be pure desire for spiritual progress and realization. Then the service is not mere physical service, such as massaging. For it to be effective, there must be no idea that you are free to give or withhold service. You must feel that your body no longer belongs to you, since you have surrendered it to the Guru, and it exists only to do him service. Then followed a catechism on the Guru's giving ignorance. Isn't Brahma pure knowledge or being? Yes. And everything else non-being or ignorance? Yes. Don't the scriptures declare that Brahma is beyond the range of speech and mind? Yes. Then the speech of the Guru is not Brahma or knowledge? No. Then you admit that what the Guru says is not knowledge, but ignorance? It seems so. Then the Guru's instruction is simply a piece of ignorance used to remove the disciple's ignorance, just as we use a thorn to remove another thorn from the foot, isn't it? I suppose so. The disciple is a jiva, whose essential nature is knowledge, isn't it? Yes. Then there is obviously no need to give him knowledge, but simply to remove the veil of ignorance that hides the existent knowledge. This, of course, is not to be done at one stroke, since the disciple is immersed in age-old ignorance and needs repeated instruction, perhaps through life after life. And what is the nature of this instruction? Through speech about what is beyond speech. Isn't it like removing a cover? Ignorance conceals the pre-existent knowledge, just as water plants cover over the surface of a pond. Clear away the plants and you have the water. You don't have to create it. It is there already. Or take another example. A cataract grows on the eye and prevents a man from seeing. Remove the cataract and he sees. Ignorance is the cataract. The universe is the efflorescence of the indescribable Maya, which is ignorance. Yet ignorance is needed to illuminate and dissolve this ignorance. Divine knowledge is to be realized, not taught. Prostration, inquiry, and service are the methods by which to obtain the grace of the Guru. It is an illusion to suppose that phenomena are real. That is the screen of ignorance which hides knowledge. Tear it off, and Brahma or knowledge will shine forth. Ignorance is the seed of samsara, birth and death. But the medicine of the Guru's grace on the eye and the screen of Maya lifts, leaving only jnana. Jnana is not something to be attained. It is eternal and self-existent. On the other hand, ignorance has a cause and an end. The root of it is the idea that the devotee is a separate being from God. Remove this, and what remains is jnana. Now, the question why Krishna referred Arjuna to other gurus instead of giving him jnana himself, did Krishna consider other jnanis separate from himself or their teaching different from his? No. So, their teaching is his, and there is no difference. Sai Baba then told Nana to bring the Bhagavad Gita and read a chapter before him each day, and he would expound it. He did so, and no record was kept. A book whose vigor and profundity one can imagine from the above fragment simply evaporated and was never written down. Even this, however, is enough to show that when Sai Baba did talk theory, it was the purest Advaita, the doctrine of non-duality. That is the very essence of spiritual teaching. Now the question of miracles. In recent times, most spiritual masters have largely abstained from miracles. The more materialistic an age is, the more it is impressed by signs and wonders, which, as Christ warned his followers, and it is universally recognized in India, are by no means always spiritual in provenance. Therefore, the use of them is usually deemed inadvisable. Or perhaps it is presumptuous to say what the master deems inadvisable or why, and is better simply to state the fact that they are sparingly used. The divine grace may manifest in various ways in the ambience of a great saint or master, but that is different. It does not imply open or deliberate acts. Devotees of Bhagavan Ramana Maharshi, the supreme sage of modern times, remarked how prayers to him were answered, sicknesses cured, dangers averted, although he overtly performed no miracle. When asked for an explanation of this, he said that it is enough for the thoughts of a jnani to be turned in any direction and the automatic divine activity begins. All such activity was as discreet and inconspicuous as possible. But not so with Sai Baba. His miracles were flamboyant. Nothing automatic there. Two stories will serve to illustrate the difference. A lady died at Tiruvannamalai. The bereaved husband could not take the body for cremation as rain was pouring down the whole day from a laden sky. And in the Indian climate, it is both unwise and illegal to keep a body more than 24 hours before burial or cremation. He went and told the Maharshi. Looking up at the sky, the Maharshi said, as anyone else might, "I think it will clear up." The devotee went back to his house and merely ordered the bullocks to be yoked to the cart to take the body into town for cremation. Such was his faith in the every word of the Maharshi. And in fact, the rain held off enough for his purpose. And now the other story. Shirdi was some 6 miles from Kopargaon, the nearest railway station. How far is Shirdi from Bombay?
3 or 4 hours.
You mean?
Of Bombay.
Not too far, though.
Not too far, it's in
the nearest railway station, and the only conveyance was a horse carriage. Some visitors, too, Sai Baba urgently needed to catch the night train in order to return to Bombay, but a terrific thunderstorm was raging. Sai Baba looked up and shouted, "Hey, enough of that! Stop it now! My children have to go back!" And the storm stopped. "Okay, stop it!" However, there was purpose in his miracles. How varied the purpose will appear later on in this book. He said, "I give my devotees what they want so that they will begin to want what I want to give them. Even apart from his miracles, there was something bizarre about Sai Baba, a strange figure teaching Hindus and Muslims alike, keeping a sacred fire burning in a mosque, raging at his devotees, even beating them with sticks, answering unspoken thoughts, flinging stones and abuse at an unbelieving visitor to drive him away, or performing a miracle to attract him, openly asking for money and then giving it away to others. He was a spiritual gargantua, one before whom gargantua is dwarfed to a schoolboy. He would fly into a towering rage for no reason that could be seen, pouring out abuse, but the storm would pass, and he would suddenly speak graciously to someone who had just arrived or was taking leave. He would repeat Islamic sacred phrases, Arabic or Persian, seldom or never Hindu, but in an undertone as though not wishing to be heard. He had strange rites too. He would stand before his ritual fire and rub coins together. One of his closest devotees, Das Ganu, had described this. Sai Baba occasionally performed strange rites between 1 and 2 in the afternoon at the mosque, alone, with a cloth screen in front of him. He would take out a purse of some 10 or 15 old coins of various denominations from a quarter anna to 1 rupee and rub them constantly, but gently, between his fingertips. I don't know whether he said any mantra the while. Their surfaces were worn smooth by this. He would sometimes say, as he rubbed them, "This is Nana's, this is Bapu's, this is Kaka's," and so on. But if anyone approached, he would gather them up and put them back in the purse and hide them. Obviously, the coins symbolized devotees on whom he was working spiritually, transmitting grace, uplifting and supporting them. Every master does so, but Sai Baba used symbols where with another there might be no outer sign.
When was this published?
1957.
That's the year after I got out of high school. I could have read it even then. I wouldn't have known what he was talking about.
He was asked to write this book.
What?
Was he asked to write this book?
No, I think he was got interested himself at all.
So Shirdi is about 6 hours from Bombay.
6 hours.
240 kilometers. Between Aurangabad and Nasik.
That's funny, I just got a copy of that book.
What?
Last month I got a copy of that book. I wrote away and got it because I couldn't find one here.
Mm. Yeah, we had one in Nova Scotia. Mm-hmm. I read it once many years ago.
It was this size too, the one that I got. Yeah. It was the same, yeah, almost.